Imagine you are flying a helicopter over the South African wilderness, and if you drop below 2,500 feet, you aren't just annoying the wildlife, you're actually breaking federal law.
Right, yeah, it is a very strict rule.
Welcome to your custom deep dive. Today we are extracting the hidden mechanics inside South Africa's National Environmental Management Protected Areas Act 57 of 2003. I know you follow environmental policy, so you get the struggle of balancing conservation with economic reality.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And this act is really the country's ultimate legal blueprint for making that balance work.
Yeah, because it's not just, drawing lines on a map.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
We are looking at a framework that physically and legally engineers how human communities interact with, well, really fragile ecosystems.
Okay, so let's unpack this core mechanism. Right at the beginning, the act officially appoints the state as the trustee of protected areas, and it's kind of like having this ultra-strict estate executor, right?
Yeah, that is a really good way to put it.
Yeah. But instead of just moving assets around, they treat the nation's biodiversity like an endangered national gold reserve. The state holds the keys, the citizens are the shareholders, and Mother Nature is the sole beneficiary.
What's fascinating here is how that specific legal framing changes the entire mechanism of conservation. I mean, it shifts it from a private, isolated endeavor into a mandatory democratic duty.
Like a wealthy landowner just arbitrarily fencing off a park for himself.
Exactly. It stops being that and becomes this national portfolio. The state is legally bound to ensure these ecologically viable areas actually represent South Africa's diverse landscapes, on behalf of all its people.
Right. But I mean, declaring the state a trustee is really just words on paper. How do they actually enforce this and stop, say, a mining conglomerate from just buying up a sensitive wetland?
Well, the act builds a physical barricade using a tier system. So at the absolute top, you have special nature reserves. These are highly sensitive ecosystems locked down strictly for scientific
We're
research.
due strictly for research, so no public access at all.
Basically none. But then, a few steps down from that, you have what are called protected environments.
Okay, and how is that different? It sounds like just a slightly weaker label.
It's not just a lesser label, actually. It acts as an ecological shock absorber. By regulating private land that borders the strict reserves, it prevents that abrupt hard edge where a pristine forest suddenly meets a commercial farm.
Oh, I see. So it creates a functional buffer zone.
Right. It enables private landowners to take collective action to conserve biodiversity in those bordering areas.
I am struggling to see how this doesn't just devolve into massive government overreach, though. Wait, so if it's a protected environment, can the government just dictate what local communities do with their ancestral land?
That is the exact tension the drafters anticipated. The law doesn't allow the state to just steamroll locals. It explicitly mandates public consultation.
Okay, so they do have a say. Like, what happens when a commercial developer comes in offering millions for access?
Well, they create mechanisms for co-management agreements. This legally binds the survival of the ecosystem to the economic survival of the people living next to it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the state and local communities formally agree on land management, and it includes tangible benefit sharing to ensure a sustainable flow of the natural resources those locals actually rely on.
Okay, so co-management handles the buffer zones. But looking back at those top-tier zones, those special nature reserves, the act deploys some serious legal teeth against big industry, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. There is an absolute ban on commercial prospecting and mining in those areas, period.
Which is huge. And that brings us back to that helicopter rule we mentioned at the start. No aircraft can fly below 2,500 feet over a special nature reserve or a World Heritage site.
Yeah, and if we connect this to the bigger picture, it tells us something profound about how the law defines ecological integrity.
Because it's not just about stopping bulldozers from tearing up the ground, right?
Exactly. It is about preventing noise pollution, too. It is about preserving the untouched character and the absolute solitude of wilderness areas.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I mean, you cannot preserve true ecological behavior if a helicopter is constantly buzzing the tree line.
Right. And for you listening, you might be wondering why the specifics of a law from 2003 matter to you today.
It is highly relevant.
Yeah, because this tier system, going from co-managed shock absorber zones to strict no-fly scientific reserves, is the exact structural blueprint other nations are trying to copy to meet modern climate goals.
Because it recognizes you can't just fence off nature. You have to integrate it. It is an intricate legal architecture that protects the physical ground, the airspace, and the local economies all simultaneously.
Which leaves us with a provocative paradox to wrap up. The act explicitly allows for nature-based tourism to create destinations and help fund these protected areas.
Right, while still strictly banning commercial development.
Exactly. So how do we prevent the very ecotourism designed to fund these protected areas from eventually disrupting the pristine solitude the law was built to protect?
That is the big question.
Definitely something to think about next time you book a wilderness safari. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.